I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. The ancient Greek myth of Narcissus, who dies in a pool of water after falling in love with his own reflection, is a cautionary tale about the dangers of self-love. Narcissists get a lot of coverage and attention, which of course they crave, but what about those people who are in a relationship with a narcissist? Maybe they're a parent or a child, a lover, a spouse, a coworker, a friend. Narcissists are master manipulators who know how to turn on the charm to make you feel special. Over time, though, that charm becomes control and hostility, and you begin to doubt yourself. You feel anxious, depressed, confused, and trapped. Our guest clinical psychologist, Dr. Ramani Durvasula, says that you can recover from the toxic abuse of narcissistic relationships. She's written several books. Her most recent one is titled It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. She has a YouTube channel where she talks about narcissism, and she is Professor Emerita of Psychology at California State University. Ramani Durvasula, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you, Marty, for having me.
You're very welcome. I almost hate to begin with the narcissist because they do get a lot of attention, but I feel as if we need to sort of define our terms so that we know who and what we are talking about. We use that phrase, that word, very loosely, but you are a psychologist, and I want to get your definition.
Yeah, we do use it loosely, and I think more often than not, we sort of use it to refer to someone who's very selfish, which is just one of the many slices of this pie. So when we use the term narcissistic, we're really referring to a person's personality style. It's not a disorder per se. It's not a diagnosis. It's simply a personality style. And by definition, personalities are stable and consistent over time. With narcissism, you have this added piece that this is a maladaptive personality style because it tends to put the person at odds with other people. People who are narcissistic tend to have low levels of empathy or certainly very inconsistent levels of empathy. They're entitled, they're grandiose, they're pathologically selfish. They have an excessive need for praise, validation, and admiration. There is a lot of arrogance. They're willing to take advantage of other people to get their needs met. They often envy or covet what other people have, or they assume other people envy them. So there's a real sort of hostility or suspiciousness of other people. And all of these traits of narcissism can manifest as manipulation, invalidation and devaluation in relationships, a dismissiveness of other people's issues, a lot of betrayal. Relationships are characterized by a lot of domination. But the one thing, the fine point I want to put on it, Marty, is that all of these sort of, that laundry list I gave you of entitlement and grandiosity and all of that, those are what we call grandiose defenses. They keep this narcissistic person sort of safe because at the core of them is a rather insecure, sort of shame-riddled person. And so the narcissistic person is always sort of ready to do battle. Heaven forbid somebody sort of poke at them or criticize them or do anything to show that they're just a regular person like the rest of us.
So underneath that bravado, even that bullying, we're talking about someone with a fragile ego?
Absolutely. Very fragile ego. And I think that that's the piece people forget because narcissistic people often present as really charming and confident and charismatic and like they have it all figured out. And they often seem to have it all figured out, right? They're in charge of everything, or they make more money, or they tend to be famous, that kind of thing. Like, that's where it's overrepresented. So as a result, we assume this, well, they've got to have it going on, so how could they possibly be insecure? My retort to that is they had to have it going on, or the world would feel like it would collapse around them.
Do they think they're nice people?
They do. And it's funny you bring that out. There's actually quite a bit of research showing that narcissistic people are very poor judges of their own empathy. They tend to over-index their own narcissism. They tend to overvalue their own empathy. In research, they say that they are more empathic than, frankly, they actually are. But they think they're actually very empathic, very nice, very generous. And so we'll often take tremendous umbrage at somebody saying, you're not empathic. What do you mean I'm not empathic? I'm the most empathic person you know. So that confuses the person in the relationship who will say, how am I reading this so wrong? And in fact, ironically, it's often empathic people who often undervalue the level of empathy they're showing. So there's this sort of, again, it's the arrogance, it's the grandiosity. And overall, narcissistic people are, they tend to lack self-reflective capacity. So they have an almost borderline delusional evaluation of themselves and their sort of overall wonderfulness.
Let me ask you the nature-nurture question. If we're talking about narcissists, are narcissists born? Are they created? Is it some version, some mix of those two influences? Is it hardwired into their personality?
So narcissism, like most all personality styles, frankly, is sort of a social developmental phenomenon. So our personalities are shaped by the environment in which we're placed. However, we're all born with something called a temperament, which could be considered a biological vulnerability. It's sort of the biological piece of our personality. Anyone who has a family, anyone who has relatives, and people say, oh my gosh, you have this little quirk, just like an aunt you've never met.
Right.
That's sort of that biological piece of personality. Anyone who spent time with little kids, especially if you've had more than one child, you'll say, yep, I had one kid that was born easier and more laughy and happy and more soothable. And I had another kid that was just sort of clenched fists from day one. That's temperament. Now, that temperament gets shaped by the environment. Honestly, the more externalizing, the more high demand the temperament, you definitely sort of up the odds that under the wrong conditions, you're going to create a narcissistic adult. But not all of those people, even with those more difficult, high demand temperaments, become narcissistic. But there's several different pathways by which narcissism can be shaped in childhood. And the difficult part here, Marty, is that none of this is sort of deterministic, meaning that if these things happen, then you have a narcissist. If these things happen, then you might get a narcissist. And when we look at the story backwards, you show me an adult narcissist, 35, 40-year-old narcissist. We can go backwards and see, yeah, all the conditions were right. But just because those conditions are present doesn't mean you're going to get a narcissistic person. And so narcissistic adults, that personality can be shaped out of a childhood, oftentimes characterized by various forms of adversity, frank abuse and trauma, witnessing abuse and violence, neglect, emotional unavailability of caregivers. Those things can play on that temperament and definitely shape out into narcissism in older age. Interestingly, there's another model that sort of argues that kids that are overvalued, told that they're very special, that they're more important than any other kid. It's not just that you're special, all kids are special, but that they're more special than anybody else. So it's almost as though that entitlement is being coached into the child. That is considered potentially to be a risk factor, though those longitudinal studies are still unfolding. And a lot of people, including myself, would argue that a parent that is feeding their child with that kind of sort of skewed sense of identity, that's its own form of emotional neglect, because that's not healthy parenting. You know, permissive parenting is a form of unhealthy parenting.
Sure.
And that can also beget narcissism. And so, but most kids raised under these conditions don't become narcissistic. But there's something that's happening in childhood that's not allowing, again, sort of this healthy ego to develop. So the child really learns to rely on external stuff and their defenses like denial and projection to get through the world. And then they do that in adulthood. But it's not everyone. And so that's why this is such a tricky bit. Because when we think about, well, how would we prevent narcissism? It's the way we prevent almost all mental health issues, which is protect children from trauma, keep them safe, and give them attuned caregivers. I mean, that's
sure,
never going to be a public
sure
policy recommendation that's going to work.
Well, let me quote something from your book, and this is about growing up in a narcissistic family system. You say it's a form of indoctrination. These family systems leave you feeling deflated, self-blaming, mm-hmm, self-devaluing, as if you are not enough. The message in these families is that you need to earn love or be the source of mm-hmm narcissistic supply to your parent to keep their love, or you are judged on the basis of what you can do for the narcissistic family member. And for a child, that's got to be a very confusing way to grow up.
Well, here's what's interesting, Marty. What I'd argue is that it's not confusing because the child doesn't know another option.
That's true.
Right? What it is it's damaging. Because now what the child has gotten into is really the model of interpersonal relationship as transaction. As I have to become what this person wants. I have to do what this person wants. I always have to attune outside of me rather than being attuned to, which is what the child needs. I am being told that I'm only useful, I'm only lovable if I'm of value to this person. And because the child has no other choice, but to attach to that caregiver. It's a survival need at that point. The child makes the accommodations and the adaptations to maintain a healthy attachment, or as healthy as possible, to this parent. So the child really then can develop almost this very well-developed external self. Like, they'll show up and be a good student, or a good soccer player, or just a helpful kid. But inside, that child is not allowed to develop a sense of self, because any time that child expresses their true them, maybe expresses a need or just acts like a child, that is shut down, and the child is often shamed. How could you do that to me? How could you disturb my evening? As though the child had done it with intent to bother the parent, as though they're equal adults, rather than the child was being the child. But the narcissistic the parent, I should say, they may or may not be narcissistic, but they're usually the narcissistic parent, will project shame onto the child, and that child will basically, the child becomes the willing holder of the parent's shame. So the child walks around with that shame, and basically walks around from childhood into adulthood with a sense of, what's wrong with me? Why am I not enough?
And just picking up on that, underscoring what you're saying, and I think this happens to some degree in all families, is that children take on certain roles within the family, whether they're the golden child or the helper, the peacekeeper, sometimes the invisible child. But what you say in these narcissistic family systems, those roles are really so strict and so enforced, it makes it impossible to be a fully developed person.
Correct. And so roles in a family are always unhealthy. Different people use different terms for them. But by definition, a role is a limiting of a person, right? And so the child can't be anything but. And the role, for example, golden child, scapegoat, is defined by how you function with that parent. It's not like you're a kid and sometimes you have good days and bad days and you like soccer and you like painting. It's, you're my special kid, or you're my problem kid, or this kid learns to be helpful, or they learn to be a little diplomat in the family to keep the level of conflict down. So the child's entire psychological self is invested in making that household, that family system, those relationships basically safer. So a role is always limiting. And so any system, especially families and especially for children, where there are these roles, by definition is unhealthy, because it does limit the child. But it serves the narcissistic parent really well.
Indeed. Well, we have much more to talk about after this very short break. And again, our guest today on The Connection is clinical psychologist Ramani Durvasula. And she has made narcissism really the centerpiece of the work that she does. She's got a new book, and it's titled It's Not You, and it's subtitled Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. And she is Professor Emerita of Psychology at California State University. And we're going to talk much more about narcissism after this short break, including her own personal experience with narcissists within her own family. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about how to deal with a narcissist. Narcissists are very skilled at manipulating other people, showering them with affection, and then undermining their sense of self. And again, our guest is clinical psychologist Ramani Durvasula, and her latest book is titled It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. Well, Ramani, let me quote from you again from your book, and you say you don't get into this work unless it's personal, and yes, for me, it's personal. I've encountered narcissism-induced invalidation, rage, betrayal, dismissiveness, manipulation, and gaslighting in my family relationships, intimate relationships, workplace relationships, and friendships. So you, in a sense, got into this line of work for your own personal struggle, and I guess your struggle to understand how these relationships happen and then how to get out of them.
Actually, I didn't. That's what's ironic. Those things happened to me, but you know, I think again, it's a big thing to take on.
Sure.
I came in through the back door. I came in through my academic research. I got really interested in narcissism and how it impacted how people engage with healthcare systems and how they take care of their own health and how that impacts other people. So I also really got interested in it because of what I was seeing in my private practice. The deeper and deeper and deeper I got in this, and really it was all absorbing, was when I kind of looked sideways and I was like, wait a minute. And of course, I'm in my own therapy, as all I think all good shrinks are. And I think I kind of caught my own therapist chuckle as though she's like, oh, I was hoping you were going to get here. Sort of this was something you had to unearth yourself. So ironically, the discovery that this was happening in a lot of places in my life was sort of an aftermarket add-on. I had been doing this research for a while, which in many ways makes me feel foolish. But then again, I understand why I had so much resistance to this framework, because everyone has resistance to this framework. So it also gave me some insight into why people don't want to see the people they care about this way.
In fact, you are, quote, another psychologist who calls this betrayal blindness, that you're living it, but you don't see it.
Yeah, this is Dr. Jennifer Fried's work, which was really influential in how I thought about this, which got at this idea of when we're betrayed by somebody where there's an incredibly vested interest in the relationship, for example, a child with a parent or a person with a long-term partner, when we're betrayed by them, even though inherently, almost somatically, we're aware that there was a betrayal of trust, to code it that way really has these really perilous kinds of, you know, fallout, the sense that we might have to end the relationship, the sense that this is not a safer relationship, and for a child that basically there's no options. So it doesn't code as a betrayal, and it kind of gets pushed to the side. It's not forgotten. And what this is why we talk more and more, we've been talking the last 30, 40 years about how trauma is encoded in the body. So we don't feel well, we're in this relationship, we're acting like this relationship is fine. The world may even think this relationship is fine, but actually inside we're falling apart. And that's sort of basically these betrayals come in. They don't get processed and encoded. We nudge them to the side. But as Dr. Fried argues, when it becomes safe to see these betrayals, maybe it's through therapy, maybe it's because we're getting social support, whatever the reason, maybe the child grows up, then we're able to see it and it hits us like a ton of bricks because we're like, oh my goodness. And this is why for a lot of people, learning about narcissism, especially for example, in parents, when they're in adulthood, it just sort of completely reconfigures the deck chairs. You're like, okay, this was not what I thought it was. And now it makes sense. And people then start lifting the self-blame. They start seeing their family in a different way. They start seeing these interactions differently. And it really starts to set them free. But it's an incredibly painful revelation when it starts to hit you, but then people feel better.
Well, and I do want to get to all of that, but let me ask you about if there is such a thing as healthy narcissism. I mean, I think we all have some degree of narcissism, making ourselves a bit of the center of the universe. Certainly children growing up, young babies and toddlers are often very self-centered. How do you see healthy narcissism?
I actually don't see healthy narcissism.
Don't. Okay.
I don't love
Fair
the term.
Enough.
I don't like it. And I'll tell you why I don't like it. That whole laundry list I gave you of low empathy and entitlement and grandiosity and the admiration and validation seeking and the willingness to take advantage of other people. Narcissism is all of those things together. Just like a cake is just not an egg. Narcissism is not just selfishness. So I think what ends up happening is that this term healthy narcissism is bandied about to really reflect what I'd consider healthy ego or healthy assertiveness. A person who is able to say, okay, I'm a person separate from you, or this isn't working for me, or I can't do that tonight. Maybe the other person in that interaction, like, what do you mean you don't want to go to the movies with me tonight? But that person might say, listen, I just work 90 hours this week. I can't. I will see you next week kind of thing, and communicate appropriately. That to me is healthy ego, not just giving in and also not yelling at the other person. A child, yes, is narcissistic by definition. That's when we get into the Freudian and the psychoanalytic work on primary narcissism. But that's not coded as this sort of unhealthy secondary pathologic narcissism that damages relationships. That basically by the time this pathological narcissism kicks in, the organism, the human being, is now older and should basically know better. The baby has to be quote unquote self selfish, because that's the only way for the baby to survive. But I think that the term healthy narcissism, it doesn't make sense, because that laundry list of qualities I gave you, right, never are all those things together ever going to be healthy. Some of them, being selfish, maybe putting your interests first from time to time, maybe advocating for yourself, I don't know, in a medical office where you're not getting the information you need and you're like, you need to give me this information now, that might look like entitlement to that person, but it might be in the larger context of a person who's always very well regulated, but this is life or death information. And so when we take one strand out, I don't know that that is unhealthy in a given condition. But when you have all that together, I don't think there's any version of that that's ever going to be healthy.
No, I appreciate that, the clarification there. Let me ask you then, and I do want to get to people in relationship with narcissists, but let me just focus one more question on the narcissist themselves, how they use their charm. It's often called love bombing. How they, I guess, pick the person that they think that they can eventually control. What are they looking for in a relationship with another person?
Yeah, so there's often this sort of this speculation that narcissistic people go out there and find the kind of sort of weak, I always say, like the broken-legged gazelle that they can take down. It's actually not the case. Narcissistic people want, like, let's use the intimate partner space as the example. Narcissistic people want partners who are all that. They want them to have status in some form. They either want them to be attractive or educated or smart or make a lot of money or come from a certain family or have whatever attributes that narcissistic person thinks are valuable. Now, could that in some cases be somebody who is seemingly, I don't know if you want to use the term subservient, like going to willing to give in to them? Absolutely. But that's because that's what that narcissistic person has coded as valuable. That's not a universal. In fact, for many narcissistic people, the idea that they were with someone who was a sort of seeming shrinking violet wouldn't work for them. So I always say to people, this narcissistic person chose you because you're very desirable. I think that a lot of people say they pick me because I'm a sucker, and that's not the case. Now, the bigger issue is not who the narcissistic person gravitates to or who they pick, but it's who gets stuck. And that's when we get into these issues of a person, for example, who maybe had narcissistic parents themselves and are used to making lots of accommodations in relationships, or a person who is hyper-empathic or very forgiving. Those people may get stuck in narcissistic relationships because they do keep making excuses for the narcissistic person's escalatingly bad behavior. But to your point, Marty, about this charm and this confidence and all of that. Now, it's not all narcissistic people. There are different kinds of narcissism. But by and large, many narcissistic people, when you first meet them, are very well put together. They are charming. They're confident. They can make good conversation. Most narcissistic people are sort of extroverted. They do well with other people. And they can communicate that confidence, which a lot of people are not able to do. So we assume they've got the goods to back it up. That's attractive. But there's another piece of narcissism that makes it so attractive that isn't as the shiny charm and charisma. It's really this capacity to study a person. So many people I've worked with have said, you know what it is? It wasn't that they bought me flowers or took me on these great trips or was some sort of genius in a genius job or had money. It wasn't that love bombed me. What love bombed me about this narcissistic person is that they had this uncanny ability to say to me exactly what I wanted to hear. Wow. And it was as though they studied me well enough to know, pointing out little things. Like, for example, I remember one woman saying to me that she said, my parents were always telling me I was dumb and I wasn't that smart and I thought I was smart, but I'm not smart. And then this narcissistic person must have picked up those little kinds of things I dropped into conversation, and everything was about, oh my gosh, you are such a smart person. I don't think the world realizes how smart you are. And they said there was no bunch of flowers or jewelry or restaurants that was ever going to be as attractive and appealing as that. So I want to break people out of this idea that love bombing is just this sort of intense, almost materialistic focus. It can also be this person who has studied you so well that they get in there and tell you what you want to hear, but yet there are other behaviors that are unhealthy in the relationship that are happening simultaneously, and yet a core wound may be getting addressed by these things we're hearing in these relationships That's what people need to be aware of in a narcissistic relationship.
So what happens? So you've got all this attention. You've got this love bombing, as it is called. But then over time, there are issues of control and sometimes hostility and gaslighting. In fact, you have 10 common patterns of trauma-bonded relationships. And in many ways, mm-hmm. that's what we're talking about, justifying abuse and invalidating behavior, experiencing chronic mm-hmm. conflict, becoming a one-stop supply shop for the narcissistic person, hiding your feelings and your needs that over time, if you're in relationship with a narcissist, it seems like you just lose that sense of yourself mm-hmm. and who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to lose your sense of self and who you are, because otherwise, unless you are up for going 15 rounds every day, it's too exhausting. And it takes us back to also this attachment. As adults, we need attachment too. Maybe not the survival way we needed it as kids, but when we believe and we do love someone and we have a life with them, we want it to work. Right. And this idea of compromising and sort of trimming bits and rough edges of ourselves, that seems like a natural thing to do in a relationship. And it's all programmed in us if we had narcissistic parents. So what happens over time is people really do sort of quit themselves. Like, I better not talk about that. I better not bring up that. I better take care of this. I'm not going to make them walk the dog. I'm not going to make them empty the dishwasher. It becomes this slow encroaching because it's the only way the relationship works. And most people, Marty, don't like conflict. They right. don't like having arguments
sure.
every day.
Sure.
So because most people are conflict averse, this kind of capitulation and this giving in, but no, people aren't actively doing it. It's sort of, well, okay, I don't need to bring that up. Oh, okay, we don't need to do that. Oh, that's a sore topic. And very, very gradually, you find yourself walking on eggshells. You're more vigilant. And it seems as though if you do say, ask, express the wrong thing, either the narcissistic person is going to react with tremendous anger and rage, which is disruptive, or they're going to do the thing that actually throws a lot more people off, is withdraw, withhold, and give the silent treatment and more of a passive-aggressive play. And for some people, that literally feels like an abandonment. For others, they say, this is more awkward than someone yelling at me. At least yelling is done in a few minutes. But now they haven't spoken to me in 6 days because I had brought up that issue with the dishwasher. So it is there's a constant dance happening. And so when people lift their eyes after 5, 10, 15, 30 years, they recognize that they completely had to abandon themselves to make this relationship, quote unquote, work. And of course, the narcissistic person's not saying, hey, thanks for giving up on yourself. That was sort of this implicit assumption in being able to create this relationship. But to your point, using the term trauma bond that I'd raised in the book, the trauma bond is a really tricky place because all these unhealthy, uncomfortable patterns we're talking about are embedded in a context of stuff that feels normal, may even feel nice. You might enjoy elements of this person. You might find them smart. You might find that their days, everyone's getting along. You might, have common interests. You might find that at times you're doing well together as a family. You go skiing together or whatever it is. And so those decent moments sprinkled in with these bad moments creates this alternation between good and bad, praise and criticism, this hope and despair. And that alternation creates this stickiness, so that when people really assess those unhealthy patterns, it's not like, oh, this is unhealthy, I got to go. They're like, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm reading this wrong because we had such a nice weekend last weekend. That alternation is what makes these relationships so tricky. And because a lot of people in the world don't see how difficult the narcissistic person is because they don't spend enough time with them. They just see thin slices of their behavior. You're, especially as an intimate partner, as a spouse, something like that, or a child of someone, you're the one who's seeing the most sort of intense version of this person, or the most sort of unhinged or uncensored version. So you're seeing something different than the world. And people in these relationships inherently doubt themselves and they say, I must be reading this wrong because we did have a nice time at dinner last night.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's clinical psychologist Ramani Devasala. We are talking about narcissists, something that she has written several books about and spends her life talking about, her professional life. And again, she's got a relatively new book and it's called It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. One of the things that you say, Ramani, in talking about these relationships is, if we're talking about the narcissist, that they are not going to change. They were that way when you found them, and they are not going to change. So it really puts the onus on the other person about what they are going to do within the confines of this relationship. And it seems that can be a really lonely thing if you're kind of struggling in this relationship by yourself.
It is very lonely, but I have to say that this awareness, we call it radical acceptance.
Yeah.
The awareness that this relationship, their patterns in this relationship, or their patterns, their behaviors in general, are not going to change, is a really rough moment for people. Because for most folks in narcissistic relationships, a lot of what was driving the train is the hope it's going to get better. It'll get better when the kids get older. It'll get better when they get the promotion. It'll get better when summer comes. It'll get better after the holidays. These goalposts are constantly moving. And the narcissistic people sort of engage in that dance. Like, oh, I'll be more available after this deadline. I'll do it next week. Like, this is constantly, you're sort of living in this future space, which is very embedded in hope, because we have this natural desire when we love someone that they could be better. But it takes a long time for people to say, okay, this really is a pattern. This is not changing. But this idea that somebody can't really change feels like quitting them. But what we know about narcissism as a personality style is that it is this maladaptive style that by definition is very rigid. It is not as amenable to change as other personality styles. And by and large, personality is relatively resistant to change. Agreeable people don't become grumpy. You know, conscientious people don't become sloppy. It's just not how it works. And so narcissism is even more resistant to change than those personality styles. And so as a result, when I'm working with people, and I'm very clear on my point of view, and I've been on it in all of my books and everything I've talked about, this isn't about an agenda of they're not going to change, so you have to leave. That's simply not an option that everyone has, nor that everybody wants. But once people are armed with this information, like, not, this is not only not going to change, but when they do hurtful things, it's still going to hurt. Just knowing this doesn't mean that when somebody says something unkind to you, that doesn't hurt. But then people are able to make very different decisions. So, for example, some people say, I'm out. If this isn't going to change, I'm out. Some people will say, okay, now that I know this, I'm not going to engage with them in the same way. Other people will say, okay, I better foster other sources of support and meaning and purpose in my life. But what it means is it opens up different kinds of possibilities. It also opens up a lot of grief. And in the early phases of radical acceptance.
And I hate to do this. Only because we're up on a break here. And I do want to get to all the things that you just put on the table for our discussion. But in the meantime, a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we are talking about narcissists today on The Connection. And our guest is Ramani Durvasula. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's got a relatively new book, came out earlier this year, titled It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we are exploring some of the risks, some of the dangers of having a relationship with a narcissist who are skilled at manipulating other people, seducing them with affection, and then undermining their well-being and sense of self. And again, our guest is clinical psychologist Dr. Ramani Durvasula. Well, let me pick up on some of the things that you said right before the break, and I just want to break them into, I guess, digestible pieces. You talked about radical self-acceptance, the idea, I guess, the realization that, look, you're not going to fix this other person. You're not going to fix the relationship, so to speak, and it's time to really focus on yourself and not the other person. So if you stay, if you decide to stay with a narcissist, how do you protect yourself, I guess, from the things that were so hurtful in the past?
So what's the importance of radical acceptance as part of the protection is understanding it's not going to change, because it's not you. That's the title of the book, right? That I think that once you can understand that regardless of what you do, they're having this internal experience that comes out in this way. So it's not what you're doing is not going to change their behavior. So it is that in terms of quote unquote protecting yourself, it's understanding you're not responsible for their or frankly anyone else's behavior, that it is not going to change, that is going to keep happening. I always say that we know radical acceptance is working in these relationships when people are no longer surprised by the bad or hurtful or the betraying behavior. It doesn't mean you're not hurt by it. It doesn't mean you're not disgusted by it, but it means you're no longer surprised by it. And simply removing that element of surprise helps people a lot. So instead of anguish and wailing and despair, people say, it's sort of like a kind of an eye roll, like, here we go again, which feels very different. It feels quite a bit more empowered. Other ways to protect yourself also include having support. Literally, Marty, one person in your life who says to you, basically, it's not you. I get it. This is tough. What they said was not okay, or helps you out of that gaslighted mess. Remember, gaslighting isn't just someone lying to you or doubting you. It's somebody literally dismantling your reality and telling you there's something wrong with you. So it's all it takes, and I can say this as a therapist, is that for many clients, they'll say, the reason therapy is so helpful for me is that just being brought back to reality on a regular basis is how I'm able to get calibrated and kind of get through life. So this is why social support is so important. Knowledge is important too. Understanding what this is, what these patterns are about, not to excuse them, but to understand there is such a consistency and frankly, a predictability. And some people who say, listen, I can't get out of this relationship, but now I'm beginning to see the stuff that sets off the really bad days here, that I can either clear the decks, I can get out, I can sort of figure out some workarounds, but I don't have to be, again, it's lifting up some of that element of surprise. But all of these kinds of self-protective, aware workaround strategies really come in on the wake of some grief, because in a way, it now feels like you're getting very tactical about someone you love, and that's not a good feeling.
Well, let me pick up on grief, because from the outside, at least, one would think once you realize you're in this toxic, narcissistic relationship, you want to get the hell out of there, and you would feel some relief to be able to sort of live a less crazy and conflicted and confusing life. What is the grief about? What are people grieving when it comes to these relationships?
Marty, they're grieving everything. So when you go through this experience of radical acceptance, the sense that this person is never going to change, this is never going to be this relationship, what I wanted it to be seen and heard and valued and loved the way I wanted or cherished, all of that goes away. It is the grief of they're grieving the childhood and the family they wanted. They're grieving that their children are not going to grow up with both of their parents around or with a model of healthy marriage. They're grieving what they thought this could be. They're grieving the number of years they spent in the relationship. They're grieving a life or a lifestyle they left behind. I mean, divorces are expensive and people find themselves no longer living in homes they lived in for 30 or 35 years or now having their kids half the time because of a custody agreement. Even if a person gets out of the relationship and says, okay, my day-to-day is easier, that was a lot of time. And it's also for people who say, I'm grieving the sense that I didn't get the stuff you were supposed to get in childhood. Like, I still don't know who I am or what I'm about. And there is no soft place to land. There is no family to turn to. So the number of things people are grieving once they have this awareness of how unchangeable and really how toxic and harmful these patterns were, it's they're grieving everything.
Once you're out of, let's say once, and I realize it's a complicated way to get out of this kind of relationship, but once you're out, what are the risks that if you were attracted to a narcissist in the first place, that you wouldn't get attracted again?
So that's a really great question, Marty. And I think this is a couple of things. We are all of us, you, me, everyone, is inherently attracted to narcissistic people because they're attractive, right? They may be, again, very smart, very charming, very charismatic, very interesting, very physically attractive. So I think that it's not as though somebody leads with exploitation and low empathy and manipulation and gaslighting. That's not how we're meeting people. So I think that number one is be kind to yourself, because if you find yourself drawn to a narcissistic person again, you may simply be being drawn to a very attractive, compelling person. Number two, I tell people, if you're coming out of an intimate relationship, a marriage, long-term relationship, committed relationship with somebody, give yourself a year down, like a year after the papers are signed, not while we moved out. I'm like, really let this psychological cut happen and give yourself a year down out of relationships. It takes about that long to make sense of what happened, to grieve what happened, to connect or reconnect with yourself, to understand the patterns that just unfolded in front of you and how you got pulled into them, and also to sort of start rewriting the book of you. Narcissistic relationships tend to take away our sense of self. We eat what they want, when they want. We set the thermostat the way they want. We go on the vacations they want. They really, in these relationships, we do find that, yeah, most of the things that we did were what they wanted to do. You sit on the couch and you watch football for 9 hours on a Sunday and you have absolutely no interest in the sport. And people say, whoa, there's a whole thing called a Sunday that doesn't involve this. So, and then in the process of that, I'll say, so how do you want to spend your time? And a lot of people say, I don't know. And I'll say, that's the work now. Wow. Not dating, not meeting someone else. Because as you find these things out about yourself, you have a clearer sense on you and are in a better position to say, yeah, no, this person's encroaching on things that matter to me. But you have to get acquainted or reacquainted with what those things are. All of those things matter as a person sort of leaves one of these relationships and goes forward. But I also have to say that in some of these relationships, it's not as simple as, okay, I'm just going to sort of sail off into the sunset. If you're the one who decided to leave the relationship, a phenomenon called post-separation abuse is not unusual. And that is, the narcissistic person doesn't like losing control. They don't like being left. In fact, abandonment is a kind of a trigger issue for narcissistic people. So they may engage in a smear campaign. They may pass rumors about you. They may keep bothering you, stalking you, sending you text messages. They may really, really try to gerrymander the entire divorce process. And these divorces can get very expensive and very contentious. This can involve custody of children. So, and for a lot of people, because they're co-parenting, it never feels like you're really out of it, right? You're on a very regular basis.
Sure.
You're having to interact with this person. So I think that this idea of I'm free of this toxic person and I'm going to go off into my new best life, it's not quite that simple. And that's a lot of the reason I wrote this book, is if this feels hard, it's because it is hard. And while I've seen countless happy endings for people who've left these relationships, these happy endings are also really, really punctuated with a lot of dark nights of the soul of, did I do the right thing? Am I the bad person? Was I wrong to see them as narcissistic? I'm really lonely. At least the devil I knew, all that stuff. Not to mention that what happens in these relationships can get filed under a phenomenon we call betrayal trauma, where a person's trust is repeatedly violated in these relationships. And so people coming out of these relationships feel like they can't trust anyone. They can't trust someone new. They don't trust the people they know. They don't trust themselves. So simply that trust building becomes a big part of the healing after one of these relationships ends.
You know, it almost feels like someone coming out of a cult where they have lost their sense of self, where their life has been controlled by other people, where there was a sense of danger. Does it feel cultish to you?
100%. In fact, a lot of us who work in this biz will say a narcissistic relationship is just a cult of two, a leader and an unwitting follower, basically. So, I mean, think about it. Every cult leader since time immemorial is either a narcissist or a psychopath. So there's no such thing as an agreeable cult leader. That's not how it works. So these are narcissistic relationships have all the vibes of a cult, of the kind of the indoctrination, and it's slow and it's gradual. And so getting out of it, a person does feel a bit unrooted. And for years and years and years and years in these relationships, people were riddled with self-doubt and self-blame. That doesn't just evaporate because you radically accept. People continue to have this doubt. And I have to say, Marty, I mean, I've been doing this for such a long time, that I tell clients, I'm going to prepare you realistically. I don't know that the self-doubt and the self-blame ever fully go away. This is why the social support becomes really, really important. And you'll see people who say, I'm still a quadruple, quintuple checker. It's not even double checking anymore. I still question some of my choices. I feel like I have to sort of sound them off against other people. And that some of these fellow travelers never quite leave when you heal from these relationships, especially when you've been in them for a long time.
And for those people that stay, I ran across a phrase in your book called gray rocking, the idea that if you're going to stay in the relationship but not get pulled into all the drama and the craziness, you're sort of impassive in a way to what's going on around you.
Yeah, so gray rocking is exactly what it sounds like. There's not very few things more boring than just a plain gray rock. We don't notice it. Right. And that's the hope, that if you give sort of one word answers and disengaged answers, that the narcissistic person will lose interest. I put that strategy in the book because it's so commonly offered. But actually, a friend and a collaborator of mine, a woman named Tina Swithin, who works with people going through these narcissistic divorces, she came up with the term yellow rocking. And I like yellow rocking so much more because yellow rocking doesn't have the sort of detached, almost cold, deposition-like communication of gray rocking. In yellow rocking, you can kind of be yourself, but you still do not get into the thickets. You do not overly engage around really kind of fraught topics. It's instead of gray rocking, which would sound like, hello, how are you?
Right,
yes.
Right. Nothing.
The backpack's there. It's more like, hey, hope you're having a good weekend. Yep, the backpacks are over there. I'll see you later. And so you're still getting the conversation done, but it's you're doing it with a little bit more warmth and a little bit of you in it. And Tina's work on yellow rocking really came out of this idea that kids that were observing co-parents, either actively in a narcissistic relationship or they've gotten divorced, it's actually destabilizing for the kids to watch this gray rocking. It feels a little bit kind of cold. And people watching the gray rocking from the outside will often look at the gray rocker as the problem. Well, maybe if you weren't so cold. So the yellow rocking allows people to be themselves, but stay focused on that main prize of remaining disengaged.
I mean, it sounds performative, but performative for the right reason, right?
Yeah. I mean, Marty, you raised something so interesting. And I struggle with this a lot when I give people kind of guidance on how to navigate the narcissistic relationships they cannot leave. Because that's where gray rocking and yellow rocking and even some of the advice I give in the book, like don't go deep, which is like don't defend, don't engage, don't explain, don't personalize. It does feel performative. But here's the rub. It was always performative. Wow. Your hypervigilance and walking on eggshells in its fashion, that wasn't performative as much as it was sort of a trauma response in a way of trying to stay safe. But that still wasn't authentic. At least with the sort of, if you will, this performative kind of like, okay, I'm not going to get sucked into this vortex anymore. I feel like it's getting people out of this really kind of terrified place in these relationships and at least taking back some ownership, taking back some power and knowing exactly what they are dealing with. And so people will often say, I don't feel like I'm spinning. I don't feel like I'm throwing all this excess psychological energy into the relationship. Yeah, absolutely. It's performative. Because when you think about it, when one person has a script and you have to follow it, which is what a narcissistic relationship is, that's a performance.
And indeed. And that's our guest, Ramani Durvasula. We are talking about narcissism, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just a minute or two before we have to say goodbye here. Is it important to forgive the narcissist? Is forgiveness important? No. You say.
No, to me, it's not. And I'll tell you why. Okay. This is a huge conversation. And it is, I have spoken to so many thousands and thousands of survivors on this one. I think we view forgiveness as sort of an eraser, that it just makes everything go away and it makes everything better. Or we view forgiveness as this sort of intervention for the forgiver, that if you forgive, you'll let go. You can let go without forgiving. Because when you really stop and think about it, forgiveness, and you look at the dictionary definition of forgiveness, it's to cease to feel resentment. So I'll always ask folks, do you no longer feel resentful that they cheated on you 5 times?
Yeah.
Do you no longer feel resentful that the way they handled your child? People are like, no, I really resent this situation. I said, then you haven't forgiven. So let's not call it that. And this is so against sort of all Western teachings, against almost all religious teachings. People like forgiveness. It feels like it puts a neat and tidy bow on it and none of us have to feel uncomfortable. I tell folks, though, that decision to forgive or not forgive is exceedingly personal. It's not something you have to go say to someone, I don't forgive you. And there's actually a very interesting body of literature that suggests that forgiving someone who repeatedly harms you actually does a fair amount of harm to the forgiver. So forgiveness all sounds great in practice, but it is predicated in this idea that you forgive and then you let go and maybe even the other person changes. And that sequence doesn't always happen. But for people to say, you know, I'm distancing myself from this. I see it clearly, but no, I don't forgive them because what they did to my life changed my life. And I put myself out on that chopping block. There are narcissistic people in my life I don't forgive because the things they did in my life changed the course of my life. Don't get me wrong, Marty. I love my life and I love the things I get to do in it, but it didn't have to be this hard. And I didn't have to be put in this much harm and face the situations of danger I faced. That wasn't okay. And so to me, those are not safe people and I do resent them. Do I think about them? No. Have I let it go? Absolutely. And I think that framework has set so many survivors free who say, I don't forgive them. And thank you for letting me know I can heal. And above all else, I'm not a bad person for not forgiving. It's a very personal decision. And if you do, that's your decision. But many people often preach forgiveness to survivors of these relationships, to which I tell survivors, just set that boundary.
We are out of time. Ramani Devasala, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. So many interesting things we talked about.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
You're very welcome. And again, her book is It's Not You. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.